Let's take a moment now to meet a man who describes himself as a serial entrepreneur. Jonathan Kaplan started his first businesses when he was a kid with a paper route, snow shoveling, then landscaping. He's had a printing company and a DJ service playing sweet 16 parties and bar mitzvahs, and that is all before Kaplan hit college. If anything, he's picked up speed since then, founding several tech companies, including the one that brought you the Flip digital camera. He sold that to Cisco for more than $500 million. Kaplan joins us from member station KQED in San Francisco to talk about his next venture. Jonathan Kaplan, good morning.
Good morning.
So your current project is setting up a chain of grilled cheese restaurants. Why grilled cheese?
Well, it's a really simple answer to that question, and that is grilled cheese makes people happy. And when I created the Flip, I wanted to really think about a way to change the way people captured and shared video, a way for consumers to feel empowered and make memories. And, you know, there's a lot of nostalgia, there's a lot of memories, and there's a lot of happiness in the very simple grilled cheese and soup.
You actually went out to Mall of America, is that right? And talked to people about what kind of food makes them happy.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Grilled cheese is one of these food items that people talk about with emotional connection. You know, when you're sitting with a friend and you say, what do you think of a salad? They're like, oh, salads are okay. But if you say, what do you think of a grilled cheese? They say, I love grilled cheese. I mean, and they conjures up memories and nostalgia. And the words that I was hearing were just so exceptional. I mean, it reminded me so much of chocolate or, you know, some other things that maybe we won't mention on the air. But it's really
comfort food.
You know, comfort food. It's a real comfort food. So I did go to the Mall of America about 10 years ago, and I wanted to test this with everyday Americans. And the reaction was pretty much the same. People love grilled cheese.
You went out to Mall of America 10 years ago. Does that mean this is an idea you've had in your back pocket all this time, just waiting for the right moment?
You know, one of the things that's interesting about entrepreneurs is they tend to have a lot of ideas all the time. And 10 years ago, I was thinking about what should I be doing next? And Flip hadn't started yet. And I just finished my last business and sold it to Sega of Japan. And I didn't know what I wanted to do. So I thought, hey, maybe I'll do a grilled cheese and soup chain. We'll call it something. I don't even know what we'll call it. And so I went to the Mall of America and did some research. And just as I was doing some research, I realized, you know, there's something else I really want to do first. And that's when Flip started, and now it's time to do the melt.
All right. So will you tell us what's in your back pocket right now that 10 years from now we'll be talking to you about?
I can't wait to come back on the air and tell you.
All right. Jonathan Kaplan, as we said, you have started a lot of businesses over the years. Maybe the highest profile up to now was the Flip camera, which eventually did sell to Cisco. They shut it down. What did you learn from that?
Well, I learned that anything is possible. When I started out, we wanted to democratize video. This was a pretty tall order to do when you had the likes of the Sonys and the Panasonics and the Canons. And, you know, you have a group of young entrepreneurs that didn't really know much about video at all. But I knew that we were onto something. We ended up selling more than 7 million units and really, I think, changing video for the better. And I'm very proud of what the team created.
Were you disappointed when it was shut down?
Well, of course, I was disappointed when it was shut down. It was very, very disappointing. But I'm also a business person, and I understand why Cisco has to make business decisions. And they're still using our technology for many things that are happening at Cisco. But if you look at that business and the idea that we were only a billion of the $45 billion in revenue that that company generates every year, you know, I have to respect their decision. But I'm really excited about the melt.
As you gear up for this new venture, have you found it hard to start a new company in the current business climate? I mean, what advice do you have for other people out there who have an idea and might have a harder time than you have had trying to get the money to get it going?
Well, I think that, you know, right now the economy is in a place where great ideas are going to get funded. There are some times in our economy in 2001, as an example, and maybe a year ago, where it was very hard to get any idea funded. But I think right now we're coming out of our recession, and I feel like great ideas will be funded. The advice that I would have for entrepreneurs is very simple, which is stick to your idea, stay focused, hire great people, and be sure that you're as passionate about your idea as you're telling everybody you are. Because if you are, if you're willing to eat hot dogs, if you're willing to take no salary, if you're willing to hear no so many times that it sounds like yes, then you'll probably be successful.
Jonathan Kaplan, thanks very much.
You're welcome. It's great to be here.
Oh, we've been talking with Jonathan Kaplan. His latest business is a chain of grilled cheese restaurants called The Melt. They open next month.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer. I'm from New Mexico, and I can tell you that if there is one thing people from that state can agree on, it is that chili is king. The deeply flavorful local pepper is ubiquitous, hanging dried in red bunches from porches, simmering fresh and green in sauces. We even have a state question that is asked in restaurants from Santa Fe in the north to my hometown of Carlsbad in the south. You want that with red or green sauce, that is. But chili, grown in New Mexico, is under assault from cheaper foreign products. This month, a new state law went into effect that makes it illegal to claim your chilies are New Mexican if they have not been grown in the state. We sent Weekend Edition's Audie Cornish to investigate.
The heart of chili pepper country in southern New Mexico is the tiny village of Hatch, which bills itself as the chili capital of the world. The heart of Hatch is the Pepper Pot restaurant.
Hi, this is Melda Aguirre. I'm the owner of the Pepper Pot restaurant in Hatch. And I guess I gotta show you how to make rellenos with our fresh peppers from Hatch.
And this kitchen is where Aguirre churns out hundreds of plates a day of chili rellenos.
And you just put cheese, or you can put a lot of people use the Spam. A lot of people don't need any meat, so they just like it with cheese in it. When it's time to make it for me for the chili festival, I have to make up to 3,000 for to use on the weekend.
Tens of thousands of hot pepper fans converge on Hatch each fall for the annual Chili Pepper Festival, all devotees of the smoky, rich flavor distinct to the New Mexico variety. Aguirre grew up picking chilies, and her brother still works the harvest each year. Chili farmers eat at her restaurant so often, they unlock the doors and let themselves in for breakfast.
Can you list some of the things on your menu that have chili in it?
Everything.
So to find out what makes the New Mexico chili so special, we headed to the Chili Pepper Institute at New Mexico State University, where we met up with extension vegetable specialist Stephanie Walker. She's like the Encyclopedia Brown of facts on hot peppers.
One is if you just bite the tip of a very hot chili pepper, as long as you don't bite into the placenta or vein, you'll get no heat from that. So it's a great trick you can play on your friends.
Fact number two,
chili peppers and bell peppers are the exact same genus and species. The heat in chili peppers is not detected by birds. Chili pepper is actually used to feed flamingos in zoos to keep them pink. The capsaicin chemicals from chili pepper are extracted for a number of uses, including put in paints that they actually will paint on boats to keep barnacles from attaching to the sides.
Not bad for someone who says her first taste of pepper was as a teenager at Taco Bell. These days, Stephanie Walker's job is to study and grow chiles. She says New Mexico's peppers get their special flavor from the environment here. High altitude, long seasons of heat and sunlight, hot days, and chilly nights. But chilies are also a tough crop for farmers because they're sensitive to drought and parasites, and they have to be harvested by hand. That's one reason the number of acres devoted to New Mexico's heritage crop has dropped more than 70% over the last two decades. And it's why Walker is supporting a new state law aimed at stopping people from labeling foreign pepper as New Mexico grown.
As with other crops in other parts of the country, we all know about the Vidalia onions. We know about other crops that really have their brand identity in place. New Mexico has that, but it's never been protected the way other crops in other parts of the country have.
Walker sees part of her job as protecting farmers like Shane Franzoy.
Oh.
And then we're just starting to see the little bitty chilies coming on. So we're in the early part of the fruiting stage, you know, setting the fruit.
Franzoy's been walking pepper fields ever since he was old enough to walk. His family has farmed in Hatch Valley for four generations. But these days, it's onions and alfalfa that are the moneymakers for the farm. The price of red chilies has dropped to the point where he's only growing them for seed. The market for the green chili, which is just a fresh version of the dried red, is a little bit better. But Shane says buyers are looking to cheaper chilies from China, India, and just south of the border. Why are your chilies more expensive than foreign chilies?
The mainly the cost of labor is, and the regulations that we have to go through to grow the chili. We're paying $7.25 an hour, and we're competing with $7.25 per day in other countries, or even less.
Even though his chilies are more expensive, Franzoy can still rely on food processors like Gene Baca at Bueno Foods. Baca is head of the New Mexico Chili Association. His family's company has been selling green chili salsa and roast for decades. His morning oatmeal is the only part of the day that doesn't include a dose of chili sauce. This is the sound of the factory room where huge machines are helping to pound, bake, and cut tortillas. This is the sound of the room where he processes green chili. It's empty because local chilies are not yet in season. And Baca is one of many producers who have pledged to sell only New Mexico-grown peppers for his company's sauces and roasts.
Now, when you make a choice to only use chilies from the state, to me, it leads to an empty room in a factory. I mean, don't you want to be using this room? And aren't you taking a hit by not using it?
You know, you're right. I mean, if you did it strictly based on economics, we'd probably be sourcing from China or from India. But that's not what we feel. We feel like we want to provide a very high-quality product, and so we concentrate our efforts on New Mexico. So that's where we put all our effort into it.
So it's worth it to you to have this room not producing any money for you right now?
Definitely. I wish I was running all the time. And that's why we need a certification program, so we can run this room all the time.
State lawmakers decided not to go for federal certification or trademark for the New Mexico chili pepper. It would have cost a lot more to enforce, but it would have allowed the state to sue in federal court when outside growers label their peppers as New Mexico grown and put U.S. Customs on the lookout for foreign imposters. Products from Idaho potatoes to Florida oranges benefit from this system. But for now, at least anywhere else in the country, you can call a leather shoe a New Mexico chili if you want.
Because just so we're clear, what you're proposing is that your state agriculture officials could come into your factory right here and make sure that this room isn't operating with chilies other than the ones you've promised out front.
Correct. If we say it's New Mexico chili, then they can come here and check. But I also think, though, that just getting it on the books really helps. And getting on the books and really publicizing it helps.
And that's why, back at the Pepper Pot, Melva Aguirre has a little sticker on her door from the Keep New Mexico Green Chili campaign. Aguirre packs and freezes bushels of green chili each season just so she can truthfully say that she serves up New Mexico-grown chilies year-round.
But you're running a business, mm-hmm. and, I mean, wouldn't it be cheaper and easier for you mm-hmm. to use mm-hmm. other chilies? Mm-hmm. Or you wouldn't have to freeze them.
No, I don't have to freeze them if I buy them. But what about your pride? What about being proud of what you do? See, if I buy chili from Mexico from another country, that's just going to be like everybody else. It's just a pride of you owning something. This is mine.
After that, Aguirre turns back to the kitchen to finish serving the lunch crowd. At the end of the day, she will be hustling home to make her husband dinner, which undoubtedly will include chili.
You like it with red or with green or with both?
For Weekend Edition, I'm Audie Cornish.
Okay.
And now, Flora Lichtman joins us for Video Pick of the Week. It feels like there should be some music for that, doesn't it? I mean, not, you know, something.
Bum, bum, bum,
yeah, you need a theme song, Flora.
Something like that.
Okay, so what's the pick this week?
The pick this week is a profile of a little New York farm. There's chickens and kale and chard, and you're probably thinking, ho-hum, I've seen a farm before.
Yes,
but
I've seen a farm before.
You may not have seen a farm like this. Mm-hmm. The backdrop is not rolling hills or anything pristine. It's New York City. So this farm is located on top of a warehouse in Brooklyn.
I don't understand. I've seen the tops of warehouses. Things do not grow on the tops of warehouses. They have concrete or asphalt or something.
Or whatever, something yucky.
Right.
So it turns out if you put down a protective root barrier and some soil, you can grow vegetables on top of a roof. And it's called a green roof. And actually, I should say that Aleshu Bayak, who's a producer at Science Friday, he's behind this video this week. And he investigated this farm, the Eagle Street Rooftop Farm in Brooklyn. and he found out all about green roofs. Now, this is a pretty intensive green roof.
Well, okay, so what's a green—I mean, I understand it's green because things are growing on it, but what's—apart from having a space to have grow some vegetables in the city, is there another advantage to doing something like this?
There do seem to be other advantages. It keeps—it insulates the building, we heard, on this shoot, so it keeps it warmer in the winter and cooler in the summer. And roofs get really hot in the summer, apparently. And the temperature stays pretty cool up there. So that's another advantage. And it turns out that for 4 inches of soil, it will absorb 1 inch of rainwater. So that's good for the sewer systems as well. So this is sort of, it seems like a prototype of what you might do with a roof, but kind of unusual.
Yeah, I get the feeling. I mean, it's an interesting direction, but is it really? It's not going to save the planet, I don't think.
Well, I think that Annie Novak might disagree with you there, Joe.
Really? Well, okay. I mean, so she hopes to do a lot of these and see them spread far and wide.
I think she hopes that more will sprout up.
Ooh, all
sorry.
Right. That's a good place to end. I think anybody who hasn't left us already should at least know that this
is
the end of
the
hour.
Well, it is the end of the hour, yeah.
That's right. Okay, thanks, Flora.
Thanks, Joe.
Our program's senior producer is Annette Heist. Charles Bergquist is our director. Flora Lichtman, who you just heard making a terrible pun, is our multimedia editor. Our producers are Christopher Intagliata, Catherine Wells, and Alessio Ubayak. Sam Flato is our production assistant. Our intern is Ian Chant. Neil Rausch is our technical director, and he's at the controls here in New York. If you missed any part of this program, perish the thought, or others, go to iTunes and subscribe to our podcast, audio and video. Go to our website at sciencefriday.com and take Sci-Fry along with you on your iPhone and Android apps, and continue a week-long discussion on Twitter, at Sci-Fry, and Facebook. We're everywhere. If you'd like to write to us, please send your letters to Science Friday, 4 West 43rd Street, Room 306, New York, New York, 10036. You can email us. The address is scifry@sciencefriday.com. I'm Joe Palca in New York.
For summer vacation, some of us long to travel and eat great food. Others are happy to stay home with a good read. Well, author Susan Jane Gilman recommends a handful of new books that let readers do all of the above.
Usually, the term food memoir makes me cringe. Is there anything really fresh to say about cooking? Happily, yes. 5 new food memoirs each bring something appealing to the table this summer. Gabrielle Hamilton's Blood, Bones, and Butter, The Inadvertent Education of a Reluctant Chef, is a gorgeous, nervy portrait of the artist as a young woman. Hamilton, owner of Prune Restaurant, just won the James Beard Best New York City Chef Award. She began working in food service haphazardly at age 13 when she was effectively abandoned by her parents. With unflinching candor and eloquence, Hamilton describes the heartache and little epiphanies that played midwife to her passion and talent as a cook. Her book isn't simply about becoming a chef, but everything messy and exquisite that feeds a life. Conversely, Life on the Line, A Chef's Story of Chasing Greatness, Facing Death, and Redefining the Way We Eat, is a story of distilled ambition. At 16, Grant Achatz already dreamt of owning a great restaurant, a famous one. At 29, after training in the most celebrated kitchens in the world, he won the James Beard Rising Star Chef Award. 2 years later, he opened Avant Garde Alinea in Chicago. And then Achatz was diagnosed with stage 4 tongue cancer. Written by Achatz and his partner Nick Kokonis, Life on the Line is a true modern-day Greek drama. Jonathan Dixon, however, simply woke up one day in his late 30s aimless and broke. Since he really loved making dinner for friends, he thought, hey, why not learn to cook? His memoir, Beaten, Seared, and Sauced, on becoming a chef at the Culinary Institute of America, is meant to be an expose of the famous school. But it's engaging more because readers realize Dixon is out of his depth long before he does. He's a dilettante, a ditherer, what most of us would be like in such a cutthroat cooking environment. His naive adventures are frustrating, but highly entertaining. Anya Cizadlo's Day of Honey, a memoir of food, love, and war, on the other hand, recounts experiences as a war correspondent in the Middle East over the past decade. In 2003, Cizadlo married an Arab-American journalist, spent her honeymoon in Baghdad, then reported from Iraq and Beirut. To understand a culture, she found it was crucial to know the cuisine. You have to eat the meal. You might think recipes for hummus wouldn't mix easily with geopolitics, but Cizadlo pulls it off. Day of Honey offers an intimate, thought-provoking look at life in an often misunderstood region, with recipes. That said, Lunch in Paris, a love story with recipes, should be an enormous cliché. As an American visiting Paris, Elizabeth Bard was swept off her feet by a Frenchman during, guess what, a French lunch. She married the man, moved to Paris, and raided the markets. Yet Bard's narrative is breezy, her observations about cultural differences spot on. She debunks the romance of France while ending chapters with straightforward recipes. Just to make sure her book was, in fact, worthwhile, I forced myself to test a few. The swordfish tartare and scallops and champagne custard, I'm happy to report, are excellent. Indulgent, indeed.
Susan Jane Gilman's latest book is Undress Me in the Temple of Heaven.
This is NPR.